probably more than that, you can imagine. Black people ran into the swamps. One of the Alfred Waddell, one of the leaders, said, "Well, we'll choke the Cape Fear with their bodies."
We have 10 seconds.
And then it returned to, then it became a majority white city. And 2 years later, Jim Crow was instituted, and there was not another black person elected from the state of North Carolina till 1992.
Wow. It is an amazing film, and I encourage people to watch it. It premieres tonight on PBS and also live streams. Yoruba Richin is co-director of American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality?
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Show your support for KBOO today by becoming a member. Just text KBOO to the phone number 44321 and join the thousands of members who make volunteer-powered radio possible.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council will consider a 10-year contract renewal with the Portland Metro Chamber and Downtown Clean and Safe. Critics of the Interstate Bridge replacement project say the new bridge design relies on outdated modeling. And youth in Washington with nowhere to go can spend longer behind bars. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 12, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland City Council will vote on a resolution on Wednesday to extend the contract with Downtown Clean and Safe for another 10 years. Downtown Clean and Safe is a nonprofit that provides cleaning, private security, marketing, and other services to a 213-block swath of downtown Portland. The nonprofit is managed by the Portland Metro Chamber, formerly the Portland Business Alliance. It's one of the city's enhanced service districts. A city auditor report released last month says Portland has done almost no oversight of these districts and that their actions could criminalize homelessness. Earlier this year, Street Roots reported on City Council approving changes to the program amidst criticisms of the program. Reporter Jeremiah Hayden spoke about the issue with KBOO's Althea Billings on KBOO News In Depth.
That contract that brings all of these services into that neighborhood is managed by the Portland Business Alliance. The contract, the fees that residents within that area pay, go straight to the City of Portland. The City of Portland contracts with the PBA, and the PBA manages the contract with Downtown Clean and Safe.
So like you mentioned, within the districts, businesses, nonprofits, and individual homeowners have to pay into the program. But because it is run by the PBA, by the Portland Business Alliance, it doesn't necessarily mean that they get to have a say in or even really a clear picture of where their money goes. How have folks been pushing back on that aspect? What are some of the things that they're worried about?
This is kind of a central point of this thing, which is that enhanced service districts were created in the 1980s. You know, by like 1988, the City of Portland adopted. It was an early adopter of this idea. And people that live within those boundaries are required, it's not a tax, specifically written to not be a tax, but they're required to pay into this fund to get these services. The Portland Business Alliance runs this contract, and that is an exclusive, it's a 501c6, so that's kind of like trade unions, you know, like Elks Lodge, like that kind of thing. They are not subject to any sort of government sort of transparency laws. Same with Downtown Clean and Safe, which is a 501c3, but that shares a lot of membership between Portland Business Alliance, who actively lobbies on sort of its own behalf. It says, you know, on behalf of businesses and residents, and Downtown Clean and Safe. So the transparency issue seems to be a big one because people are paying significant amounts of money into this thing, but they're not able to move the needle on where the funding actually goes. I do think that it's important to point out that the Downtown Clean and Safe one that they operate has an annual budget of $8.37 million, That's a projected budget for 2026. It's close to that right now. The Lloyd, for transparency here, the Lloyd District has a $750,000 budget, and the Central East Side together has $1.5 million budget. So they're making significantly more money off of this than any of the other ones.
That was Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden speaking with us earlier this year on KBOO News In Depth. The Portland City Council will vote tomorrow on an early renewal of the contract they have with Downtown Clean and Safe and the Portland Metro Chamber. Some have criticized the move by the council, since only one of the current members will likely serve in the new city government, and the new contract would last 10 years. Oregon and Washington are working to jointly replace the Interstate 5 bridge over the Columbia River that connects the two states. The Interstate Bridge Replacement Project, or IBR, is taking public comment until November 18th. Advocacy group Just Crossing Alliance says the traffic modeling the project is using is wrong, and it justifies building more lanes across the bridge than are actually needed. They say the project has used static traffic modeling instead of dynamic traffic modeling. They also say that the bottleneck at the bridge is actually caused at a different point in the road, not the bridge, so the replacement that is planned won't actually ease traffic. IBR program administrator Greg Johnson says that criticism misses the mark, telling Willamette Week that the project is just a 5-mile segment of the highway, so it can't address every problem. The new bridge is planned to have possible tolling, safety shoulders, and seismic improvements. Public comment is open until November 18th. People under the age of 18 in Washington state sometimes spend a longer time incarcerated than they need because they are considered unaccompanied. This mainly impacts young people who are experiencing homelessness. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Incarcerated young people in Washington state can spend a longer time in detention if they don't have a place to go upon release. Some of the reasons for longer stays for people under the age of 18 include youth who are experiencing homelessness or are in between homeless shelters. Sarah Zier is with Team Child, a Washington state-based advocacy group for youth involved with the juvenile justice system. She says overstaying in detention is devastating for the youth who experience it.
They're facing layers of challenges. Not only do they not have a safe place to sleep or to go home to, or family and supportive adults to meet their needs, but then they're held in detention where they're isolated and they don't have a chance of those things either.
Zier says many barriers exist to ensuring young people have a place to go when they're released. She notes that people don't have a right to determine where they reside until they're 18 years old. A U.S. Supreme Court decision earlier this year allows cities to pass laws punishing people experiencing homelessness, which could exacerbate the situation for young people in Washington. DeGale Cooper is head of Youth Care, an organization working to end youth homelessness in King County. She says Black, Indigenous, and people of color disproportionately experience homelessness in the county. Cooper says the city of Seattle and the state have policies in place to end youth homelessness, but funding remains an issue.
Young people are homeless all over our state, and if we don't have the financial resources to support organizations that can house these young people for either short periods of time or long periods of time, then the policy can't work.
State lawmakers passed a measure that went into effect in 2021, stating that any unaccompanied youth discharged from a public-funded system of care will be discharged into safe and stable housing. However, the state has yet to achieve this. Zier says it's important to solve the issue of unaccompanied youth held in detention, even though it's a small number of people population-wise.
From an equity perspective, it's really important that our state stick to commitments we've made to house young people and also to give young people who are detained for offenses opportunities to engage in treatment instead of being held in detention where their needs aren't met.
Team Child offers some recommendations for addressing the issue of youth who are stuck in detention. It says the state should allow faster access to court for young people in detention and adjust the legal emancipation and minor guardianships to better serve people under age 18. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Immigrant rights groups and libertarians react to Trump's win. President-elect names philosophical allies and deregulators to White House positions, and Democrats wonder how they can fight Trump policies given the GOP's congressional majority. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Donald Trump has demonized us and our communities at every turn of this election and has promised to tear apart the families who have contributed so much more to our great state than he ever has. We stopped him before. We will stop him again.
Madeleine Galaz with the New York Immigration Coalition is one of many vowing to fight Donald Trump's mass deportation plans, though the president-elect says deporting as many as 10 million people would solve the nation's immigration problems. The personal and economic repercussions would be profound. Analysts project it would create a nationwide labor shortage and cost the economy up to $1.7 trillion in GDP. Trump has named hardliner Thomas Homan as second-term border czar. The former acting ICE director championed the family separation policy during Trump's first term and says ICE agents will restart large-scale immigration arrests at job sites. Librarians are concerned that Project 2025, the roadmap for a second Trump term, envisions ending all federal funding for state and public libraries. It would also make librarians subject to criminal charges for having books deemed pornographic on library shelves. Peter Bromberg with Every Library says that's code for certain types of books.
We see that oftentimes pornography becomes a stand-in for just LGBTQ materials. So anything that has an LGBTQ character, even if it's in a picture book, is framed as pornographic.
Trump has named former New York Congressman Lee Zeldin as the next head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Zeldin has supported drastic deregulation and could act on the president-elect's stated position that climate change is a hoax. Eric Draper is the former director of the Florida Park Service.
They are going to move quickly in the direction of more fossil fuel production, so more oil and gas drilling on public lands, and possibly off our coast.
Republicans have now secured enough seats to run both the House and the Senate. Washington Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal says with a conservative majority on the Supreme Court and the GOP controlling both Congress and the White House, Democratic influence will be limited. She says the battles will likely start with appointments.
So I think we're going to continue to see a number of people that have disturbing histories being appointed to many of these positions. We're going to have to figure out how we fight that best.
Another immediate job for Congress will be renewing a farm bill already a year overdue. In his first term, Trump took a deregulatory stance on factory farming and agriculture. Sentient Science reporter Seth Milstein says not only did he roll back animal welfare and environmental protections, but he also eased the school nutrition rules.
Trump, as president, lowered the standards for school lunches. He decreased the minimum amount of vegetables required for a meal. I believe he also increased the maximum amount of sodium allowed in school lunches.
Other Trump appointees include New York Representative Elise Stefanik as the new United Nations ambassador and Florida Representative Mike Walls as national security advisor. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A champion of rights for older LGBTQ plus folks has received recognition for her volunteer work in Oregon. Liz James is the winner of the 2024 AARP Andrus Award for Community Service, thanks to her engagement in a number of efforts to improve the health and equity of LGBTQ plus people in the state. She says volunteering is a vital part of her life.
Volunteering gives me purpose, social connection, opportunities to learn and grow, and to make a difference.
James lives in Southern Oregon. She's the chair of the Oregon LGBTQ Plus Aging Coalition, chair of the Rogue Valley Council of Governments Joint Senior Advisory Council, and a volunteer with AARP Oregon. James stresses that LGBTQ Plus folks are not a monolith and that they exist in every community. She says they're not a single community, but many communities. She does note that there are specific health risks and needs for people who are LGBTQ+, and that discrimination does still affect their living conditions. She adds poverty and suicidal ideation are higher for them.
Data shows we're twice as likely to be single and living alone. We're more likely to be estranged from family. We're half as likely to have a relative to call. We're four times less likely to have children and almost 1.5 times more likely to be primary caregivers.
James was also instrumental in passing Senate Bill 99, which established the Bill of Rights in long-term and community-based care facilities for LGBTQ, IA2S+, residents and residents living with HIV.
First of all, it prescribed very specific non-discrimination protections that have to be physically posted and provided to all residents and adhered to, and there is accountability for violations built into it.
She notes that the bill also requires training for staff in long-term care facilities. James is serving on the LGBTQIA2S+ subcommittee of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, which was established by Senate Bill 99 and started this year. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy and windy with an overnight low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 56 degrees. Today in history, in 2021, a court in California officially ends the 14-year conservatorship over pop singer Britney Spears. A social movement called for her to be released from the conservatorship, where she alleged abuse and coercion at the hands of her father and family. Since then, Spears has become a symbol of conservatorship law reform. The quote of the day is from English writer Joseph McCabe, who said, quote, "An idea or institution may arise for one reason and be maintained for quite a different reason," end quote. A tree replanting ceremony in Central Oregon celebrates renewal and regrowth. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Regrowth and renewal were the themes of a special replanting ceremony in Blue River, Oregon, over the weekend. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the event was also to highlight the history of Native Americans in the Mackenzie River Corridor.
About 30 people gathered to accept white oak seedlings that were blessed and sprinkled with tobacco. Dietrich Peters of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde coordinated the event.
Come on up, we'll get you some tobacco and you can offer your prayers as well.
Catherine Wilson of the group Mackenzie Real said that while much of this was to help restore Blue River's landscape after the devastating Holiday Farm Fire of 2020, it was also to highlight the activity of Native people who crossed through before colonization. She said there was one clear takeaway from the event by those present.
Well, by the sounds of the sobs, the healing, the river and the land just seemed to be so joyous. I didn't expect that.
Attendees took oak tree seedlings to plant across the region. Wilson says she'll hold similar events soon to complement Blue River's natural rejuvenation as it keeps building homes and facilities. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Hundreds of volunteers from Utah and Idaho recently gathered to help the northwestern band of the Shoshone Nation with restoration efforts at the site of the Bear River Massacre. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Clarissa Casper of the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio has more.
Rios Pacheco stood on the land where in 1863 his ancestors were victims of one of the deadliest massacres of Native Americans in United States history. Behind him, across the site of the Bear River Massacre, hundreds of volunteers planted Native shrubs and trees, a collective effort to heal what was taken from both the land and the northwestern band of the Shoshone Nation. For Pacheco, who serves as the tribe's spiritual leader, planting Native plants on the land where hundreds of his ancestors' lives were stolen is a way to not only restore the ecological balance of the area, but also to heal the spirits of his people. Once you plant something in the ground, he said, life is restored. Through the plants, he feels connected to his ancestors. Planting Native species on this sacred ground is a way for his people to return and heal, much like a plant regenerates from its own seeds. In honoring the memories of those who survived, the plants offer both renewal and forgiveness for the past, he said.
That's just like the plants. When you plant them, the forgiveness comes by taking care of them, fertilizing them, watering them, so that way that plant will grow again.
The northwestern band of the Shoshone Nation began its journey to ecologically and spiritually restore the site of the Bear River Massacre in 2018, when it purchased approximately 350 acres of their ancestral land just north of Preston, Idaho. The tribe's efforts to heal a site named Wutaagwa, which directly translates to Bear River, are also meant to honor the plants that used to be abundant in the area. As volunteers worked, Pacheco observed them and heard them share stories about the plants they planted last year.
You're not just elevating the landscape, you're elevating your inner spirits.
Although the tribe has only involved the broader public in its project since 2023, a great deal of work has been done to prepare the land for the new plants. For the past 3 years, the Utah Conservation Corps has been removing thousands of invasive Russian olive trees that have invaded Woodaagua's floodplain since the massacre. This tree, according to UCC Northern Regional Coordinator Ben Borgman Winter, outcompetes the native vegetation the tribe hopes to revive in the area.
This is a really special space, a sacred space. Look how many hundreds of volunteers are here right now from all over Utah, all over Idaho. It's a pretty special project. We're very honored to be involved in that.
The tribe's big picture vision for the land includes planting 300,000 native shrubs and trees, cleaning up the land's creeks, and restoring degraded agricultural fields into wetlands abundant with life. I'm Clarissa Casper.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard oral arguments Monday on a case brought by Attorney General Josh Call to determine whether an 1849 law, which is interpreted by some to mean abortion is illegal in Wisconsin, still applies today. Reproductive rights experts say whatever the outcome, the state lacks accessible abortion services for those in need. Judith Ruiz Branch has this update.
It's now up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court justices to decide the fate of an abortion law from the mid-1800s. A circuit court determined last year that an 1849 law doesn't apply to medically consented abortions in Wisconsin. The high court heard arguments Monday about whether a 1985 state law overrides the older one, allowing abortions before the point at which a fetus could survive outside the womb. Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, says while the impact of this case is critically important, even if the 1849 law is determined to be unenforceable, returning to the status quo would mean a dire landscape for abortion access.
Even though abortion is technically available at clinics in Wisconsin right now, it's heavily restricted because of insurance and Medicaid prohibitions. People have to pay out of pocket for a service that should be covered by insurance.
The 1849 law, which was brought to light after Roe v. Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, prompted a statewide freeze on abortion services for more than a year. Higgins says if Wisconsin's high court rules the law still applies today, the state would be looking at another abortion freeze. Abortion access disproportionately affects those who are already the most marginalized, Higgins says. She notes while people from all walks of life may find themselves needing abortion care, factors like poverty and racism make it much harder for some to achieve reproductive autonomy compared to those with more economic and social resources.
Those effects make it much harder for folks to be able to access contraceptive care, be in relationships that are stable and healthy and communicative, be able to see past the end of the day, right, into one's future, if you are, again, sort of focused mostly on your own economic scarcity or figuring out how to feed your kids or figuring out how not to get evicted.
The 1976 Hyde Amendment, established 3 years after Roe v. Wade, prohibits the use of federal funds for abortion. Higgins says she hopes federal lawmakers will focus more on this amendment when considering the barriers to abortion care. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Donald Trump has been reelected as president, which has big implications for America on the world stage. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. In this episode, he says the Trump nightmare has returned. As Sinclair Lewis once wrote, when fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. So it is. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In his novel, The Plot Against America, Philip Roth depicts the rise to the presidency in the late 1930s of Charles Lindbergh, the pilot who made the first transatlantic solo flight. Lindbergh made several trips to Nazi Germany and, quote, expressed quite openly his high regard for Hitler, calling Germany the world's most interesting nation and its leader a great man, all while Hitler was in the midst of his pogrom of the Jews. When it was suggested to Lindbergh that, in light of Hitler's savagery, he return the garish medal given him by Air Marshal Goering, Lindbergh said that would constitute an unnecessary insult to the Nazi leadership. Now the American people have turned fiction into fact, electing an admirer of Hitler and deflecting concerns about his chief bankroller, another Hitler admirer. Granted that fascist has become a very loose term of opprobrium to apply to dictatorial personalities, it's still worth using. if only to clarify the frightening tendencies of would-be dictators. That means Donald Trump, who has said, like Roth's Lindbergh, that Hitler did some good things. He has never disavowed that belief. General Mark Milley has called Trump a fascist, and General John Kelly, Trump's former chief of staff, has followed suit. Kelly, in a series of interviews published October 22nd, said Trump's behavior fit into the general definition of fascist. Trump wanted the kinds of generals Hitler had, Kelly reported, men who would show Trump the same deference Hitler's generals showed him. Elon Musk, Trump's sidekick, is protected by his enormous wealth. When he channels fascist ideas, he pays no penalty. To wit, quote, from CNN, Musk invoked the names of two German Nazis in a tweet, attempting, as he so often does, to make a joke. Musk was responding to a Der Spiegel article in Germany that compared him to a media mogul who helped Klitt Hitler climb to power, unquote. A month earlier, Musk promoted Tucker Carlson's widely condemned interview with a Nazi apologist who said the murder of Jews in concentration camps was humane and that Winston Churchill was the chief villain of World War II. Musk later deleted his ex post, but he called the interview very interesting and worth watching. Now, thanks to an exclusive report by the Wall Street Journal, we also know that Musk and Vladimir Putin, a fellow fascist, have regularly talked, and not just about the weather. Musk's favors to Russia include allowing Russian disinformation on X. Keep in mind that Musk has a top secret security clearance for his SpaceX satellites, has poured huge sums into Trump's campaign, and has been promised a high position in a Trump presidency. Fiona Hill, a top advisor to Trump on Russia, who broke with him over Ukraine, said of Musk in a recent interview that his ambitions are mind-boggling. Quote, he seeks to not just get contracts from the state, but to try to capture the state, which is frankly what he's doing in supporting Trump's election. Musk is hoping to actually own the state. He sees Trump, obviously, as a pathway to power. Kamala Harris promised a new generation of leadership. What we just got is a promise to dismantle the state. As the conservative writer Daniel McCarthy triumphantly puts it in the New York Times, Mr. Trump's victory amounts to a public vote of no confidence in the leaders and institutions that have shaped American life since the end of the Cold War 35 years ago, unquote. Now, he says, Trump promises to, quote, recreate the nation's institutions under a new set of standards that would better serve American citizens. That's a sly way of bidding adieu to democracy. When fascism comes to America, Sinclair Lewis wrote, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. Our worst nightmare has now happened. Fascism with popular support. Trump and his sycophants dominate all three branches of government. The notion of checks and balances is out the window. Christian nationalism is ascendant. Strongman rule is the claimed mandate. And going after enemies of the people will be a priority after January 20th. It's all in the Project 2025 playbook. We already have a glimpse at what lies ahead. The Washington Post and LA Times bending to their billionaire's owner's decision not to endorse Kamala. Be prepared for Trump's version of Kristallnacht. MAGAites ransacking media offices, hauling Democratic opponents and disloyal Republicans before Trump-appointed judges, tolerating widespread displays of anti-Semitism and racism, eliminating reproductive and other women's rights, attacking environmental and human rights groups, and removing thousands of deep state civil servants. We have met the enemy, and they is us, as Pogo said. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 12, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Judith Ruiz Branch, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So I'm recording this on November 9th. I feel like I need to timestamp this intro for reasons that should be pretty obvious, as we all collectively live through the unfolding trauma of the 2024 election results. I'm going to share a conversation I had yesterday with two of my colleagues in the climate justice world that I found really helpful in starting to process what this election could mean for climate justice and our movement, and how to engage in these early stages. First, though, I hope you'll indulge me as I share a few of my initial feelings. Okay, deep breath. I have to admit, right up top, I am really struggling, and I'm not here today to put on a brave face and tell anyone that it's going to be okay. We have a long, dark road ahead of us. I think it's okay to feel whatever feelings come up. I also think it's important to explore those feelings and go beneath our surface reaction. For example, when I'm not feeling completely numb or in denial, my primary feelings in the past few days have just been rage and a deep sense of hopelessness and despair. But underneath those emotions is sadness and grief for all that we've lost and stand to lose, all the needless suffering and division and toxicity that is to come.